I sometimes fantasize about life without language. I imagine it would mean, like, no self-chatter. You could just look around, eat some food, chase a toy mouse, a cat. I'm picturing being my cat, freed of the shackles of language. But the reality, of course, is that language has given us a lot. That I'm able to form ideas in my head and put those ideas in your head is one of the great marvels of human life, I think. We owe a lot to words. But what are these great ideas that we're trying to give each other? Oh, you know, judgment, shame, those sorts of things. We use words a lot, but one thing we seem to love doing is expressing our ideas about what's right and wrong, how one should act, why you're a bad person. Apparently, there is no human language without at least some morally loaded words. In fact, even the world's smallest language is prepared for judgment. That language is called Tokipona. It was invented by the Canadian linguist Sonia Lang in 2001. She posted an early version online, and it took off. The language was an exercise in simplicity and positivity. The language only has 120 to 137 words, depending on who's counting. That's it. Barely more than 100 words. You could learn it in a day. But wouldn't you know, some of those few words translate to immoral, wrong, good, and right, like as in human rights. We need our languages to serve our sense of morality. But this all doesn't mean that this word and concept of morality works exactly the same way everywhere in the world. There's some great research I really love by the psychologist Emma Buchtel on the meaning of morality in different cultures. It started with a practical challenge. She was an American who had moved to China, and she worried about unwittingly breaking moral rules she didn't know about. But were the rules different in China? To find out, she turned to language. In Chinese, and I am for sure going to say this wrong, but in Chinese, the accepted translation for the word immoral is budaode. So she surveyed a bunch of American people, asking them to give examples of behaviors that are immoral, and she surveyed a bunch of Chinese folks, asking them to give examples of behaviors that are budaode. And for sure, since we're apparently talking about the same concept in just two different languages, both groups gave lots of the same examples. But not always. Chinese folks were using budaode to refer to things that Americans would not use the word immoral to describe. Things having to do with what English speakers might call incivility. So the words we use powerfully communicate deep societal ideas. But those words are always embedded in some cultural context. So anyhow, does my wordless cat lead her blissful existence because she doesn't have to worry about right and wrong? I don't know if I buy that we need language to make moral judgments. But since we do have language, we sure love to use it that way. You're listening to Opinion Science, the show about our opinions, where they come from, and how they change. I'm Andy Littrell, and this week I'm excited to bring you my conversation with Morteza Degani. He's an associate professor of psychology and computer science at the University of Southern California. His lab, appropriately enough, is called the Morality and Language Lab. He uses sophisticated analytics to churn through the words people are using to talk to each other. From that, he and his colleagues can get an idea of people's moral sensibilities and the consequences of letting morality imbue our opinions on important issues. As a heads up, one of the things I asked Morteza about at the very beginning of our conversation is the artwork on his lab website. I find it really striking. It makes more of a statement than I'm used to seeing on academics' websites. You should check it out. I don't really have the expertise to describe it well, but it's a play on traditional Persian two-dimensional illustration with characters interacting with everything from old-school parchment documents to modern iPads. That might not be the perfect description, but I think it at least helps you appreciate the first bit of our conversation. Hey, speaking of, let's get right to it. Obviously, in doing background research on people before I talk to them, I spend plenty of time on people's websites. And you might have the most beautiful academic website I've ever seen. I'm curious, could you describe like what, I mean, you obviously know what I'm talking about, like what that imagery is, just so for people who are listening only to this, and then give me a little bit of the backstory about like where that came from and why you've chosen that to represent your lab?
That's a very good question. I think it took me a good decade to sort of become comfortable with sort of integrating my cultural background in my work. And as I'm getting more and more interested in moral, sacred, and political issues in the Middle East, I thought I should have a, you know, sort of an entry to my website that better presents both the diversity in my lab, in terms of, you know, people who work there, the techniques that we use, but also an image that says something about myself and where I come from. So the painting is done by a very interesting young artist in Iran, an activist whose work I you know, I started looking through Instagram and I really liked, and we had these conversations about the type of work that I do and how I wanted the difference. First of all, on the style of the painting, which is, you know, a style of Persian miniatures, and, you know, the type of people I wanted to be there. I wanted to represent the modern aspect of the work as well. So you see like a neural network on one of the walls, and there are people holding like computers and stuff. So, you know, it both represents the modern techniques, but it's sort of maybe showing that the root of some of the issues that we're looking at are as old as that type of painting itself.
Yeah, that was that, if I were to put on my armchair art critic hat, it would be like that's sort of what I noticed. Like there's this kind of analog quills and paper alongside tablets. And a lot of your work is on social media dynamics. But my guess was that you're trying to say that, you know, the things that we're doing online are taking advantage of the same brain architecture that's been in place forever.
Absolutely.
And we're not really talking about new stuff. It's just in a new box.
Absolutely. I don't see myself as a social media researcher. I use social media data because it's convenient to use. But I'm broadly interested in, you know, the role of morality, specifically moral rhetoric, in sort of shifting people towards prejudice, hate, extremism, etc.
So we'll rewind the tape a little bit to get to your origin story, because I think you've had a unique trajectory that got you to the kind of work that you do. So your PhD is in computer science, is that right?
That's right.
So why did you do that?
Well, to be fully honest, and I think it's important these days to talk about the sort of the struggles of first generation people to get into grad school. The first year that I applied to 14, 15 positions, and I did not get in anywhere. I had no research background. My GRE scores were low. The second year, I improved the GRE scores a little bit, and I, you know, did some research in some labs without having any publications. And I applied to 13 schools, and I basically got into one. And that was the program at Northwestern, which, you know, on it's sort of on paper, it looked like a great program because it was sort of one of the only, back in the time, one of the only interdisciplinary computer science programs. And I could get a certificate in cognitive science. So that's how I chose that program. I mean, there was no choosing. That was the only option, pretty much. But when I started doing the when I started grad school and I started participating in the research of that lab, I realized that the work that they were trying to do was essentially to try to bring psychology to AI. And, you know, I wasn't too thrilled with the methodology. It was old-fashioned symbolic AI kind of an approach. But then through that Northwestern sort of interdisciplinary collaborative opportunity that the program provided, I started participating in a lot of psychology research. So I started working with Doug Medine, Dedrick Gentner, and I simply loved that work. When I joined Doug Medine's lab as a postdoc, I essentially realized that I can do the opposite. I can try to bring AI to psychology. And that's what I started doing. So I have not taken a single social psychology class, yet I'm an associate professor of social psychology. And this is the journey that got me here. My frustration, first of all, with the research that was being done in moral psychology back then. We were in, you know, the trolley era back then, and I thought that moral behavior and moral language can be captured more sort of organically through analyzing people's writings and people's behavior, and that can potentially complement a lot of the abstract lab-based studies that were being done at the time. So when I started talking to people about capturing moral language through text, people thought I was crazy. I remember I had a conversation with Jonathan Haidt back in the day, and he basically told me, well, why don't you use moral foundations theory? And we're developing this moral foundations dictionary, you know, start using that. So that was my entry, essentially, moral psychology starting from symbolic AI. Hmm.
So you had had the idea to look at text as a marker of morality before that dictionary was published. Is that right? So that it was bubbling around the same time, it seemed like.
Bubbling around the same time. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of Luke papers coming out. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, reading those papers, I thought, well, we can do the same thing with morality. And I, you know, coming from computer science, I immediately realized the sort of the limitations of the dictionary-based approaches. And I thought, well, you know, we have latent semantic analysis, and we can probably do a lot more than just looking at dictionaries. Obviously, this is like, you know, decades before ChatGPT. And essentially, the first couple of papers came out by integrating moral foundation dictionary with latent semantic analysis.
So I want to pick up a thread of is, so those the programs you were applying to originally, those were all computer science programs initially, mm-hmm. right? Oh no, okay.
No, I applied to psych. I applied to, you know, labs that I'm currently collaborating with, and I still bug them. I'm like, I applied to your lab. You didn't give me admission, but now we're collaborating. So, you know, that's cool. But, you know, you didn't admit me to your lab originally.
So you knew pretty early that this connection to psychology was ultimately like that was a thing that you were pursuing, whether you could put a finger on it or not.
So when I was doing my undergrad, I remember the first AI class that I took. I knew that I wanted to do something with AI, and that was, you know, that was the first introduction to AI. The first day of class at UCLA, he started the class by asking, "What do we need in order to make an intelligent machine?" And I kept saying, "We need emotions. We need emotions." And he said, no, we don't need emotions. We need logic. We need math. We need to be able to search. We need vision. And I realized that there is something more than the classic cold AI that was being taught at the time. So back then it was, you know, Bayesian networks were really hot, and that was, you know, probabilistic reasoning, combining it with first order logic. That was the hot, you know, research topics of the day, which to this day I find really cool, but I also don't think that's necessarily how we humans think all the time. So I started attending Keith Holyoke's cognitive science brown bags in the psychology department as an undergrad, then as a master's student. And I was just amazed by, you know, the research that was being presented and how we can do so much more with computational methods, with more advanced computational methods.
This is clearly showing that I have no idea how this world works, but like, what is research in computer science look like? Like, I understand psychology research. You design a study, you collect the data, you analyze the data, you move on. But the job of a computer science researcher is to do what? Like, what's the day look like?
That's a very good question. So if we think of psychology research as hypothesis driven, I don't think a lot of computer science research is like that. Computer science research is mostly problem driven. So you have a problem and you want to see how the current state of the art techniques perform on that task and how you can improve on it. A lot of times this includes simply optimization. It includes using a different class of models. But more and more these days, it includes bringing in research from other fields. For example, the work that my computer science students do, it includes, you know, understanding like the social psychology of bias and trying to sort of implement those theories and those perspectives in doing AI work. So I would say if traditionally the work was very much problem driven, at least the way some parts of AI work these days is, well, we have this algorithm, we have this system. How can we make it better? How can we gain more insights into its operation? And, you know, people are bringing perspectives from different disciplines. My lab tries to bring perspective from social psychology. I mean, I think I should pause and say that there is a specific field within computer science, and that's theory, computer theory. And that's all like proving theorems and making, you know, proving the complexity of theorems and whether something is, whether some task is, we're theoretically able to come up with an algorithm that can accomplish this task in a particular time frame or not. But I was leaving basically that field aside when saying that computer mm-hmm. science work is mostly problem focused. Mm-hmm.
So you start bridging these worlds, pulling on social science, pulling on computer science, and what were those first kinds of bridges that you started to sort of see a vision for morality as a thing you could study when you put both of these sets of glasses on?
Well, I think if I want to take a step back, I'm very much interested. I've always been interested in sort of the dark side of morality, how morality can lead into hate, how morality can lead into extremism. So not just how morality makes us better cooperative species, but also how it can do the very opposite. I grew up in Iran, you know, from the beginning of the Islamic Revolution till I was 19, under 8 years of war. So I sort of experienced how the regime would use moral rhetoric in order to sacralize different domains and how it would try to manipulate people's behavior that way. So to me, this was fascinating. And I thought that, you know, understanding this phenomena would be really important in dealing not just with the issues in the Middle East, but also with issues here in the U.S., where essentially, more and more we're seeing parties focusing and utilizing moral rhetoric in order to change voting behavior, et cetera, et cetera.
And so you take that and what do you do with it? What are those? There are some. I know you did some early work analyzing different kinds of text bodies. It kind of maybe connected to some of the things that you were just talking about. But what was that?
So maybe the first work. Was it the first paper? Well, the first two papers. One of the first two papers. It looked at the rhetoric around Ground Zero Mosque, which, if you remember, this was over a decade ago, but it was a very controversial issue. There were a lot of rhetoric that, you know, mostly started from the alt-right, but, you know, of course, when that starts, you'll see a mirroring rhetoric from the other side as well. And I thought that was a good sort of example start looking at, and especially because there was a lot of social media activity about this Ground Zero Mosque, about the debates. There were a lot of blogs written about the debate. There were a lot of, you know, newspapers, both on the extreme right and the left, discussing different issues related to the Ground Zero Mosque. And I, you know, again, the work was not necessarily hypothesis driven. I just wanted to look at the moral rhetoric around this particular issue using different techniques. So in that paper, we use the Moral Foundations Dictionary, we use topic modeling, I believe we use latent semantic analysis to, you know, basically try to look at the different angles of the debate from the different sides.
So for people who have never heard of the concept of a latent semantic analysis or dictionaries or any of this, what a lot of this can get pretty abstract, but like, if you were to describe kind of what is going on when you take this enormous heap of words and try to make sense of it, like, what are you actually doing with that information?
Sure. So basically, what there are different approaches to doing text analysis in psychology, and this work is, you know, generally inspired by Jamie Pennebaker's groundbreaking work on analyzing language through these dictionaries, which are set of words that are related to a particular topic. So if we want to, you know, look at the dynamics of anger during, I don't know, therapy sessions, let's say, couple therapy sessions, then we basically count the number of times that each person uses one of these words that we a priori designated as, you know, an anger word or negative emotion words. So we simply count them with the hypothesis that the more someone uses these words, the more likely it is that it's sort of an indicative of their psychological state. So that's basically the classical approach to doing text analysis in psychology. There are various other approaches that go beyond simple counting. So what, you know, techniques such as latent semantic analysis do is that they construct the meaning of different words according to essentially the neighbors of those words. So they look at the context in which the word apple appears in, and they try to essentially build the meaning of the word apple based on the various different contexts in which the word shows up. And if you do this across a large corpus of text, then theoretically, you will essentially have an idea of various different contexts in which a particular word can appear in, and that tells us something about the meaning of that word. Now, techniques that go beyond latent semantic analysis, they, for example, learn how to predict the meaning of a word based on the context. And it's an optimization problem. So they, as they sort of go through the text, these representations get better and better, and the predictions essentially become better and better. Now, you know, with transformer architectures and more state-of-the-art neural networks, context becomes a lot longer than a smaller window, and techniques such as, you know, you can, for example, if you're analyzing a New York Times article, you can't just look at all the article, take all the article as a context for a particular word. So you need to have your technique pay attention, quote unquote, attention to specific words that are predictive of the meaning of the target words.
So you do all that. You have these blogs on Ground Zero Mosques. What can all of that, like, what do you learn about it when you apply these sorts of strategies to understanding the words in these blogs? What kinds of insights can we pull from it?
I know we're talking about one of my papers, but it's been a decade since I wrote that. So I'm just trying to remember. There were different things that we did. So we looked at the emotional timeline of the debate. We looked at sort of the timeline of the moral rhetoric related to the events. We looked at how the different sides talk about the other side. So we tried to see what are the best predictors of the Republican, quote unquote, Republican posts compared to, quote unquote, the Democrat posts. And what we essentially found was that words that are indicative, or words that are degrading of the out-group, are best predictors of the in-group text. So if I want to predict whether a particular blog post was written by a Republican or a Democrat, I just need to look at how they're talking about the out-group. And if a Republican is sort of using words that are degrading of the left, then that blog post is most likely was written by a Republican rather than a Democrat.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot on a project that I know you would have set aside years ago.
No, you should. Absolutely, you should.
I mean, one of the incredible things is I had a little bit of a hard time prepping for this because you and your lab have done so many different things, even though they're in the same world. And so that just strikes me as, like, you know, one of the first forays into doing this kind of thing. And the bigger question is just, like, what are the kinds of things we can learn about psychology by looking at the words that people use when they talk about things. So that's one example, and this can open the door to others. So, like, if you're just a kind of free associate on that, you know, what are the sorts of things about the way that we engage with morally loaded stuff in the world that we can come to understand by looking at the words people use when they write about that stuff?
Yeah. So one of my... moving away from the initial lines of work, I soon realized that we cannot analyze language for the sake of analyzing language. We cannot only look at text and make grand psychological claims. If we want to do that, we need to do more than correlational studies. We need to have experiments, and we need to look at behavior. So we need to connect language to behavior. So I would say one of the papers that I still like is my paper on purity homophily. So that was a paper that came out in JP General, and it was one of the first papers that basically combine this type of correlational social media analysis with sort of classical social psychological experimentation. What we did in the social media analysis was that we basically looked at the type of rhetoric that different users, the type of moral rhetoric that different users in our corpus used, and try to predict the distance of the users based on the similarity of their language. And what we saw was that the best predictor for distance was purity rhetoric. And if people were using similar purity rhetoric, they were more likely to be closer to one another compared to vice versa. And this was orders of magnitude better in sort of accuracy in predicting social media distance than other types of moral rhetoric. Then what we did was that we tried to basically establish a causal link using experimentation. And, you know, this we used, again, classical social psych paradigms where, you know, we would tell participants, we would first assess participants' moral concerns, and then we would tell them, hey, there's this other person who shares your concerns about purity in such a way or of harm in this other way. How closely are you willing to sit to this other participant? How willing are you to accept this person as a member of your family, et cetera, et cetera? And we essentially replicated the same findings, that purity was the best predictor of social distance in experimental settings as well. So for me, that was the first step to basically combining large-scale text analysis correlational studies with tight social psychological experimentation. I would say the next work that I think is probably one of my favorites is where we looked at the moral rhetoric during a protest. This was back in 2017 or 16. It was one of the Black Lives Matter protests. And we predicted hourly rates of arrest by the Baltimore Police Department based on frequency of or rate of moralization online. And we saw that we can predict hourly rates of arrest based on the degree of moralization on Twitter. And again, for me, that was the first work that made a link between online moralization and offline activity, offline violence, in a sense. And then again, in that work, we followed the same procedure after showing the correlational analysis using sophisticated time series analysis and Granger causality, you know, controlling for various aspects such as rates of arrest in the previous year, previous hours, etc. We relied on experimentation. So we would assess to the degree that people moralize a particular issue, and then we would ask them how supportive they are of, you know, counter protests taking violent dimensions of some sort. And then we farther looked at not just the degree of self-moralization, but how, you know, essentially in an environment like Twitter, it's not just how much moralization you are doing, but it's also very much dependent on how much moralization you perceive from others around you. And experimentally, we showed that, yes, individual moralization is important, but people are willing to resort to violence when not only they moralize an issue, but people around them also moralize the issue.
These examples are helpful too, like you said, in bridging the, because I imagine a criticism is of some of the social media work is it's all so insular to go like, oh, this stuff happens on Twitter. Fine, I guess. Like, what do we really know about the world? And I always remember I did in college, I competed on for like the speech team. And one of the events that they would have people do was what they called something like rhetorical analysis or something. And the whole point was to take a piece of communication and ask like, is this using a certain kind of rhetoric? And they go through and they go, it does this and it does this and it does this. Therefore, yes, it's using this form of rhetoric. And I'd always be like, okay, fine, so I guess. What? But yeah, so what? Like, is it better to use that kind of rhetoric? Like, what's the actual consequence of doing this? And what I like about this and the other kind of work that bridges across, you know, where the data are coming from, is it really is about like, what is the consequence or even just what is it tied to, right? Like, it's hard, you know, you can try your darndest to establish causality, but you can't always get there perfectly. But still, you can at least say like, the thing that's happening on this weird digital world is absolutely tied to the world we're all actually living in.
Right. It's at least replicating, right? In sort of the real world. It's not due to Twitter changing its algorithm and we seeing some sort of weird behavior online. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not some artifact of the website we happen to be looking at, but it's we're actually picking up, taking the pulse of people as they're moving through the world.
Exactly. Right.
So, okay, I'm gonna play you dirty and ask you to define morality, which is the kind of thing. So, as someone you know, I study moral rhetoric also, and as someone who comes from research and persuasion into the moral psych sphere, I just keep waiting for someone to define morality. Like, what makes a moral judgment a moral judgment, and not just any other kind of judgment? And like, what makes moral rhetoric anything different from all the other kinds of ways in which we talk about our thoughts? And so for you, in your approach, like, is there something unique to this moral space? Is it just happened to be a useful, like, there are already concepts that have been established, so it's easier just to do it? Or is there something actually unique about moral rhetoric and moralization?
That's a very good question. The short answer is I basically get away from defining morality by relying on the moral foundations theory. And we can talk about that. Is there something special about morality? I think so. Again, growing up in a culture that resorted to morality in explaining many awful, violent behavior, and seeing that people that actually worked for some people, I always thought, and I still do, that there is something special about morality. That, you know, there is a domain of our cognition and behavior that is separate from cost-benefit analysis. That we do things in that domain that, you know, if we want to take a utilitarian perspective, it might not be in our best personal interest. We're not maximizing utilities there. When someone is willing to give their life to protect a piece of land, they're not necessarily maximizing their utility, right? When that land is not a mere resource anymore, and when it has transformed into something sacred, when that, you know, it's worth giving life for, I think there is something that distinguishes that type of behavior compared to, you know, our normal day-to-day operations.
So when something becomes sacred, what happens? Like, what does that actually mean exactly?
You're asking the wrong person.
Well, you're the person I'm talking to.
I just know the feelings that happen. What happens when something becomes sacred? I think when something becomes sacred, the type of emotions and the type of reasoning that is applied in the domains that that thing is involved in changes. I think we become more emotional, more irrational in, you know, in by the definition of utilitarian theories, and we may resort in the type of behavior that outside of that domain might not seem logical.
I was curious to see, again, to sort of pull from the past, you had put together a computational model of moral decision making. And, to do that, you do have to figure out, like, well, what is this thing going to do? Like, I'm going to put in inputs, and what is the output that I want? And what are the kinds of parameters I need to set in place that make this a moral decision making machine and not just, you know, a resource optimizing machine? Is that something that is sort of tucked away neatly in the basement, or is that anything that you think about anymore, a kind of mechanistic approach to moral decision-making?
I think it's something that is tucked away in the basement that, you know, sometimes sneak out and I think about it. I did that work just to wrap up my degree. It wasn't work that I was in love with. I never published the full dissertation, but in that work, basically the idea is that there are these two modes of decision making. There is one that, again, it tries to calculate the costs and benefits of the decision, and it chooses the decision that provides the maximum utility. In the other one, if it picks up that there are sacred or moral values involved in the dilemma, it resorts to analogy from previous stories, from previous experiences, from previous decisions. And it basically uses structure mapping to sort of bring in analogies from past decisions in order to solve the current dilemma. So it doesn't use cost-benefit analysis, and it tries to see if there is something in the memory that resembles that story, and it tries to make a decision using the previously solved decision. So I was always interested in the role of cultural stories and how they shape our decision-making, and that was essentially an attempt to try to model that process of how, when there is a story that is so ingrained in your psychology, how can that affect your future decision making?
Yeah, it strikes me that maybe there's an insight there about, like, what morality is, right? Is leaning on cultural stories. Like, could that do it all? Could that be all of it? Like, this just mode of thinking where you're not weighing costs and benefits, but you're just recalling these sort of anecdotal cues to how these decisions get made.
I think so. I mean, I think I'm more comfortable with that definition than compared to a lot of evolutionary theories. And, you know, I've written about them as well, such as pathogen avoidance, et cetera, that are out there. I think religion provides that, or at least, you know, until the 18th century for the West, religion provided that framework, those cultural stories. If we look at the stories within the big religions, they're all moral, right? And if you look at religious scholars, even today, they resort to those stories that were written, you know, a couple of thousand years ago in order to make decisions. There is a particular group of essentially ayatollahs whose job is exactly that. You go to them with a particular dilemma, and they try to see from the stories that have been passed on from the prophets and the imams, how can they draw conclusions? How can they draw an analogy from those dilemmas in order to solve the problem that was handed to them? And they write about it, and they have books. And, you know, you can't always go to the Grand Ayatollah with your dilemma. So you go to these books, which are essentially, you know, books about morality that are more in tuned, if you want to call it in tuned, but at least more contemporary than the stories in the Quran and in the Hadith and all that.
It kind of reminds me of like legal precedents when exactly. a case cites. Exactly. It's just like, well, there's this case from 20 years ago that said this, so I guess that's right.
That's exactly the same thing. Yes, I completely agree.
I was curious, you mentioned sort of the convenience of moral foundations theory in doing this kind of work, and it does strike me that like that one study of these sermons and like that just they've made these list of words to do this one study, and unknowingly I think they just set the playbook for all of this work that was going to come after it. And so just by way of for folks who are not as familiar, right, it's this notion that there are five-ish pillars of morality. We can sort of separate them reasonably cleanly. We have different words that can load onto each of them. And so we look for evidence that like some of these pillars are better represented in some places than others. So if you were to scrap all that and say, we're going to start from zero and we're going to say, here is how we quantify morality in public discourse. Do you have a sense of how you would do that?
If you're asking me today, 2023, I think my answer is different than when I reached out to Jesse Graham and Jonathan Haidt, you know, 10, 12 years ago. Back then, I had this, again, gut feeling from just growing up in an Islamic culture that there is more to morality than care and harm. And that there are these different sort of separate constructs that they're all moral, but they result in different types of behavior, and certain things and certain behaviors fall in one and not the other. So I still am very much a believer in moral pluralism. Theories that are not pluralistic are very much weird. So they might work really well for, you know, the upper middle class Americans. But these days I strongly believe that at least there is, a space semantically, cognitively, psychologically, that encompasses care, fairness, etc. And there is sort of another circle that encompasses issues related to purity. So these days for me, purity is one, the rest are separate from purity. I think purity is very special. I think purity has to do, you know, goes back to very much religious findings, and the way that people treat sacred entities is very much evident in everyday life of non-weird populations.
So since I'm talking to the you of 2023, what is next on the horizon? You've got this machine of a lab that is doing all sorts of cool stuff. What are sort of the questions that you're itching to answer now?
So we've been looking at morality and hate for the past couple of years. We've, you know, not only looked at sort of the overlap between moral language and hateful language, but we've done it with geospatial techniques as well, looking at adherence to different moral foundations at the county level in the U.S. and frequency of hate groups in the U.S. And we've, you know, experimentally, we've shown a connection as well. More and more, I'm getting interested in going beyond the US and the West broadly in issues related to prejudice, hate, and morality. So, you know, if I had all the funding in the world and all the time in the world, I would probably focus on issues related to, for example, honor killings, but more broadly, the moralization and politicization of the female body here in the US, but probably more specifically in the Middle East. I think some of the uprisings that we are seeing in the Middle East these days, including my back home in Iran, they're very much connected to issues related to morality, issues related to specifically purity and women's rights more broadly. And I would say from the socio-psychological perspective, those are the type of issues that I'm interested in to get involved in and to look at in the near future. From the computer science side, again, we've improved techniques for detection of hate speech online. We're looking at the type of biases that are induced into machine learning models through human annotations, through background data, and how those might result in biased decisions by the model. We're basically taking that line of work and expanding it to analyze body cam videos of the police here in LA. So we have a very interesting project looking at over 10,000 videos of body cam videos, it's a collaboration with various different researchers and the police department and LAPD. So I would say these are the big projects, looking at moralization and politicization in the intersection of women's rights globally, maybe more specifically in the Middle East because of my personal interests, but also on the AI side and more locally in my current home in LA, looking at potential issues that can be picked up through annotations and through machine learning by looking at large-scale behaviors of interaction in, you know, the shadow of power, essentially.
That's great. Well, I will keep an eye out for all of that and be very interested to read about it. But in the meantime, I'm going to say thank you for taking all this time to talk about your work, digging back into things you might not have thought about for a few years. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.
Alrighty, that'll do it for another episode of Opinion Science. Thank you so much to Morteza Dekhani for taking the time to talk about his work. I've been a fan for a while, so it was great to chat. As always, check out the webpage for this episode for links to Morteza's website and some of the research that came up today. Also, shout out to a recent chapter by Morteza and his former student Mohammed Attari for my claim in the introduction that all languages have moral lexicons. I don't know how they know that that's true, but they said it, and so then I said it. So that's my source. That chapter also is what turned me on to Tokipona, the world's smallest language, so kudos to them. To fill your life to the brim with this podcast project of mine, make sure you're subscribed to it, or you follow it, or you have a calendar reminder to check for new episodes. Whatever your system is, I'd love to have you back. OpinionSciencePodcast.com is the place for all the old episodes and other bits and bobs. Bits and bobs. Is that the saying? It is now. Bits and bobs are there. And look for me and Opinion Science on all the social medias. That's all for this time. See you back in a couple weeks for more Opinion Science. Maybe by then I'll be over this cold. Bye-bye.